You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Welcome to Before They Were Live, an ongoing and extremely nerdy conversation through the Disney animated canon in chronological order. We are, as ever, interested in playing our part in a healthy ecosystem of art and criticism and fandom, paying attention to the ways stories shape our collective imaginations. Hopefully along the way, we enrich the viewing experience and have some fun too. We are discussing the 64th film in the canon, Zootopia 2. If you've been perhaps living in an abandoned reptile village buried in snow for the last 100 years, you might have missed that this movie came out for the holidays of 2025. It is directed and written by the Disney Animated Studios chief creative officer, Jared Bush. This is technically the second film released on his watch as COO, but seeing as it was only about 2 months between his takeover and Moana 2, I think it's fair to say that this is actually his first movie as COO. This is his third director credit after co-directing the original Zootopia and also Encanto. He also has writing credit on both Moana and Moana 2. There was a time, believe it or not, when Disney Animated Studios did not do sequels. That ended in 1990 with Rescuers Down Under, but now Zootopia 2 is the seventh sequel in the canon. Since Ralph Breaks the Internet, half of the movies released have been sequels. Both of the latest movies are sequels. This year we'll get an original called Hexed, but then we'll get Frozen 3, keeping their 50% batting average up, I guess. Why does this keep happening? Well, Zootopia 2 was the second highest grossing animated film of all time. And in the top 10 of that list, 7 are sequels and 1 is a remake. So that is why we cannot have nice things. My co-host, Michael Farmer, is dead. Those are words I'm glad I don't have to say. Hey, Michael.
How you doing, Josh? I was sure you were going to say that I was your, I was your pack. Is that what he says?
Oh yeah, my fluffle.
Yeah, well, that's a bunch of rabbits.
Yeah. There was. This movie is not short on great one-liners and funny dialogue. That's for sure. I had plenty to choose from.
Yeah, I. It's a very funny movie. I laughed more than I've laughed at a Disney movie in a long time.
Yeah, I think the comedy it was definitely hitting on all cylinders for the comedy. So yeah, I kind of felt there's a line in the movie where the chief officer, police officer, is talking to Judy Hopps, and he says, "Despite my best efforts to avoid it, I like you." Yeah. that's a little bit how I feel about this movie.
That's about right.
But we needed a good one. It's been a streak. We talked about this at the end of our Moana 2 episode, that there have not been many streaks of like three real stinkers, and we had three real stinkers leading up to this movie, and more for you, I think, because I actually liked Encanto and you did not. I think it's an even longer streak for you of stinkers.
I didn't hate Encanto or Raya and the Last Dragon, but I didn't love them. This I think is definitely better than them. I think it's their best film since Ralph Breaks the Internet, and actually it's a very similar movie to Ralph Breaks the Internet in terms of like what it's trying to say.
It definitely had Ralph type vibes. Both of the Zootopia movies I think did, you know. I mean, just Ralph is so full. I mean, Ralph was the first one they did The original Ralph, not Breaks the Internet, but both of them did this, where they just had the various different worlds that they're entering into, and each one has kind of its own, like, you know, feel and color palette and stuff like that. And I feel like they definitely leveraged that idea from Ralph in the first Zootopia, and then again in this one we get a couple. You know, we went to Tundra Town, I think, in the first movie. I didn't rewatch it, but definitely the water area. I forget what it's called now. Is all new for this movie, so we get some new locales.
Right, and I would say the other thing it has in common, both of them have in common with Wreck-It Ralph, is the density of the jokes, which is not a quality I generally associate with Disney, but it's worth noting Rich Moore directed both the original Ralph and the original Zootopia, and Rich Moore was an animator for The Simpsons. So I think probably that Simpsons DNA is part of why these movies are so funny.
Yeah, that makes sense for sure. So, yeah, definitely had a good time. And I watched it twice. I try and usually watch them twice, especially if I haven't seen them before. And Evangeline watched it with me, or watched part of it the first time and all of it the second time.
Once you decided it wasn't evil like the first one, you were willing to let her watch it.
Right. And she's like, you laughed at that same part last time. So it's the jokes even work on the rewatch time, at least for me.
Well, and I'm sure I did not watch it twice, but it's so dense, and it's both visually and dialogically dense. So I'm sure there's lots of stuff you didn't catch the first time, lots of background gags and.
Oh yeah, I'm sure there's stuff that I still haven't caught as far. I mean, the backgrounds are, it's amazing. Like, you know, early in this podcast, I remember talking about, you know, the painterly backgrounds and how beautiful they were. And Disney's really gone away from that, but this is something else, you know, like this is like, it's filled to the brim with, you know, like you said, like extra, there's extra moving characters back there. There's gags. There's just so much that they can do now that they're creating within a computer that would have taken, you know, eons to, you know, draw all that stuff out by hand. That, it's a very different aesthetic, but for sure I'm sure there's a ton of stuff that I still haven't seen,
right.
Even having watched this movie twice.
Yeah. And again, that's something it would have in common with Wreck-It Ralph. Although Wreck-It Ralph is so referential in terms of, you know, it's always pointing outside the movie to these video game universes. And Zootopia mm-hmm. does a little of that. There's a few references to other movies and stuff like that. But I would say it's more self-contained in that sense than Wreck-It Ralph is.
Yeah, definitely more so than Wreck-It Ralph, but also the puns are, I mean, especially the visual puns are everywhere, and especially in the way of pointing outside the movie, like, you know, Nick Wilde gets onto whatever it's called. Instead of Hulu, it's Zulu or something, you know,
right.
And like all the titles that he's, you know, scrolling through are puns.
I think they actually called it Zoo Hulu. Because, of course, Disney owns Hulu, or they did. I don't know if they still do. So they're obviously not going to let you forget the actual name of the service.
Right. But YouTube is YouTube, but it's, you know, EWE-tube. So, I mean, just there's a lot of that in here, too.
Yeah, that's true. But it doesn't feel like it's engaging with a world created by somebody else, which is what the original Wreck-It Ralph feels like. Although that's not a bad thing. That's not a criticism of Wreck-It Ralph, but it's just a difference in the two movies is that Wreck-It Ralph largely is stepping into a world that was created by other people, and Zootopia, funny I should put it that way, Zootopia kind of creates its own world. What I'm referring to is this Malcolm Gladwell's podcast Revisionist History did a two-part episode on a theory that Zootopia was stolen from a writer named Gary. Do you remember his last name? His first name is Gary.
I don't remember his last name. No, I'm sorry.
Which
the snake?
Zootopia was stolen from a writer named Gary. His last name
Did you hear that, Josh?
I could not as loud as when you're speaking, but yes, I could hear it in the background.
It's so funny. My phone apparently thought I was asking it questions. Anyway, I think we encouraged our listeners to go listen to that Gladwell series last month when we said we were going to talk about this. I don't know how convinced I was by it, but the funny thing about that series is that apparently if it's true, and this Gary fella really did invent Zootopia, his vision for the first movie was that they would attempt to change their nature and not be able to, which is, mm-hmm. you know, such a better concept than what they did with the first Zootopia, which is, you know, carnivores don't have to be carnivores because human nature doesn't exist.
Right. Yeah. It's been funny, like listening to that episode and then preparing for this one. You know, most reviewers who are reviewing this will make some reference back to the original Zootopia, and few were as hard on it, I think, as you and I were, as just, you know, this, because it's like, I don't know, Zootopia's message is so, like, you know, the gospel message these days, you know, I mean, I don't mean that in, like, you know what I mean?
Right. Like, it's telling people what they already want to hear. It's telling people what animated movies have been telling people for 20 years. It just does it in a more blatantly anti-natural way, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. And so not many people are either picking up on that or, I don't know, excited about tearing that down, I guess, the way we were. But anyway, it was interesting and funny because, I mean, there were so many... I don't know. There's like just different takes on like what exactly that movie was talking about. And they even actually reference it in this movie at one point. So the mayor of this, in this town is a former actor, and he is played by our favorite. what's his name? Michael Patrick.
Patrick Warburton. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Putty.
Oh my goodness. Putty. Yes. And he says, you know, when he's introducing Hops and Nick Wilde, he says, you know, they did such a great job, you know, curing, whatever. I totally botched the line. I'm so sorry.
I don't remember what the line is either.
Yeah, but it's basically like, oh, all stereotypes are gone now, you know, like, whatever, you know, good job, guys. Now we can all come together to do something. But yeah, it's funny, the types of stereotypes that people thought the first one was addressing was actually a wider spectrum than I would have thought, you know, from the way we talked about it. So that was interesting. I don't know where I was going with that. I'm sorry. That whole section just, yeah. Sorry.
No, that's all right. That's all right. I would say that this movie does not have very much of that. I think the philosophy of the movie is a little bit muddled, but I definitely would not have any kind of ethical problem with the philosophy, because this is much more about two people with divergent views of the world learning to complement each other.
Right.
Know, it's about hope and cynicism. Kind of finding a middle ground, which you know, I think is a pretty good message.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, the summation of it, you know, within the movie world is, what makes you you and what makes me me is what makes us us, or something like that. You know, it's not quite like that, but it's something like that. It's what makes us stronger, or something. Which I think, yeah, you're right. It's a pretty good message. And but I do feel like this one, it's, you can apply it in some different ways. Like, there's different things going on inside this movie. And even, like you were mentioning a second ago with Malcolm Gladwell's theory, it feels like the first movie was, I felt like, was very on the nose. And the point I was trying to make, and not succeeding, I don't think, was that other people didn't see it as on the nose as we did. Whereas this movie, I felt like, was a little less on the nose. It's still pretty on the nose, but like, was more open to a variety of interpretation, which I think is what makes the movie better. You know, like, it's more enjoyable in that way, in that it's a little, there's actually some subtext within the movie, you know, and not just text.
Right.
So whether the theory is correct or not, like, it's fun to have a movie that you can actually even make a theory about, you know, like, it'd be hard to make a theory about anything that was going on in, you know, Wish or Strange World, or, you know, just these the past few that we've seen.
Right. Boy, those movies were stupid.
Yeah. So one thing I wanted to ask you about with this movie is, one of the things that this movie seems to be poking at and teasing is the therapy speak, which you have brought up several times over the last, you know, this era of Disney, and specifically with Encanto, which Jared Bush also directed. So do you think Jared Bush heard your critique and is responding to that?
I think we're very powerful people in Hollywood.
Yeah, I agree.
did you feel like it was, I mean, it has the scene making fun of therapy for sure.
Yeah,
you know, she's the therapy animal, and that was a funny scene. But at the end, doesn't it just reinforce the idea that everybody needs to go to therapy, and that Judy Hopps needs a dozen therapists, or however she puts it, and Nick Wilde also needs to go to therapy because he has undealt with trauma from his childhood. I felt like falser moments in the movie.
Yeah. Well, I felt it was, maybe it was wishful thinking on my part, but the way I read that scene was that they were poking fun at that, because it went on for so long and it was so dry and like just over the top, that I felt like they were actually making fun of all that, like, of that whole idea, not that they were sincere in it. You know, like, I felt like that's why it felt insincere, was because they weren't sincere. It was a joke.
Interesting. Yeah.
I think the reconciliation was real. I think so, like, in the storyline of the movie, I think the reconciliation was real, but in the way that I feel like the reconciliation was at the same time played for laughs by the way that they kept kind of one-upping each other with the therapy speak stuff.
I'll have to go back and
watch it. That's the way I felt it.
I'll have to go back and watch it, because I read that as pretty straightforward, but maybe you're right.
Maybe it was, I don't know.
Well, so much in the movie is arch, although part of Nick's character arc in the movie is that he has to learn not to make a joke out of everything. So it would seem weird to me to undercut a serious moment like that when that's your character arc. But
yeah, that's
also, I mean, it's kind of an artistic failure on either front on that. Although I prefer your interpretation to mine, just in terms of the quality of the movie.
Yeah. And I wonder if that's, like, going back to, like, the Simpsons idea, like, I wonder if it's just kind of like part of the reason why the philosophy of the movie feels a little muddled, maybe, is because, I mean, you're a bigger Simpsons fan than I am. I like the Simpsons a lot. I just mean that you've delved into it more than I have, but it feels like nothing is sacred for the Simpsons. Like, everything's okay to, like, make a joke about, you know, regardless of the philosophy or whatever, you know, it's
well,
like a joke. The joke is the ultimate thing. And so, like, I wonder if, like, that kind of carries over, where it's like they don't really have a philosophical underpinning on if they feel like therapy speak is good or bad or not. It's just whatever's funny works.
Well, and also the kind of signature move of emotional moments in The Simpsons is that they'll play it straight and then immediately undercut it. There's an early episode that tells the story of where Homer and Marge are telling the story of their courtship, basically, and young Homer in the flashback says, "I'm gonna hug you and kiss you and never let you go," and it cuts to modern day Homer and he says, "And I never did," which is a sweet moment but pretty saccharine, and then immediately Bart starts gagging.
Right.
So you might be right that, I mean, to the degree this movie is influenced by The Simpsons, which I think it obviously is, I mean, maybe they want to undercut that moment. But if they do, it's a pretty subtle undercutting.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Compared to Bart gagging.
Yes, that's true. Gives everybody what they want, I guess. What you can get out of that scene, what you want to get out of it. But on that point, like you said, that part felt a little flat for you. I felt like, so as much as we're praising this movie right now, I feel like the first third of this movie was amazing. Like it was really good. And then the second two thirds are fine. Like they're okay. So the first third ends with them escaping from the Linksley's manor. They have the snake. Gary shows up. They're trying to foil him from stealing the journal, and they half succeed and half don't succeed, because halfway through that heist they switch sides, and or at least Judy does. Nick's never quite switched sides, but Judy switches sides and is on the side of the snake, and so she doesn't prevent him from stealing it, but then she does aid and abet him in stealing it, so I guess that's a win. but that's like the third point of the movie is right there, and that I feel like that everything that happened before that, it's just like beat beat beat, and it's so funny and so clever, and then it kind of lagged for me a little bit after that.
So do you think the problem is just that the pace of the movie slows down after that point? I mean, that's when they go to the marshland and back to the tundra.
Yeah, it does slow down. And the marshland, I liked the marshland. So I'm not saying it went from like an A to an F. It's just like it went from like an A to, I don't know, a B, B minus in places, you know? So like the marshland is good, but it's, I don't know. Like it's not as good as that first part, you know? I feel like there's more they could have done, or it could have been paced differently or something. And then once they really get into after the marshland, the whole plot with the 100 years ago and the snakes, and like once they just kind of get into like the lore dumping, I guess. It's just like, it felt like the story is interesting and cool, but just the way they told it, it didn't do a lot for me. Like they kind of just like do this like flashback thing where Judy's narrating, but like, there's no way she's like picking this all up, you know, on her own.
Yeah.
Like,
how did she figure it out?
Yeah. There's no way she figured it out. So like they could have been reading the journal and maybe figured it out, but like, it's happening at the same time that Gary is, because Gary is a pit viper. He is, he's able to see heat marks on the journal when it's heated, because it's made out of metal. That part I thought was clever, but yeah, I don't know. And then after that, like, it's just kind of this build to the final climax, which is, I don't know, it's, you know, it's fine, but it's just very straightforward from that point on, you know, like it's just there's not much to it, I guess.
You certainly lose the imaginative world building after the first third, or after they go through the marsh.
Yeah. Yeah. The marsh is cool. And there's some really funny parts in the marsh. But it just
I think the part of the movie I laughed the loudest at was the Danny Trejo Jesus lizard saying something like, "I'm just like everybody else," and then immediately skitters across the surface of the water. That made me laugh so hard.
Yeah, it was it was very funny. For sure.
So
just, I mean, because those Jesus Christ lizards, like, they are really, really funny. Like, just the way they move is funny, you know?
So, right.
Like, even without him saying anything, it's just funny to see him doing it. So, yeah, I'm not saying the gags disappear. I'm just saying, like, it went from, like, oh, my gosh, this is a really, really, really solid movie to this is an okay movie.
Yeah.
With some funny parts.
Yeah.
And it just didn't hold together for me.
Yeah, it did seem like they were having trouble getting to the point they needed to get to. And they never really solved that on a screenplay level.
Yeah.
One thing that bothered me is that they knew that the key to understanding this was in that journal. And yet I don't remember a point at which they open the journal and read and try to read it.
No, they don't. So they, I mean, they do. They open it just to find out where the switch is for the light switch. But that's the part of the movie that felt a little like, I mean, it almost got to, this is going to sound really mean, but I mean, what else are we doing this podcast for? But like, it got a little like Dora Explorer-y, you know, like they had like the thing open and they're like, okay, first we have to go to the oldest wall and then we have to flip the switch. It's down, you know, like, I mean, it got really like granular for a moment when they did open the journal of like, here's the steps we have to follow, you know? And it was just like, okay, there's the rest of our movie for it, you know?
But even that was interesting. Even that was after Gary had already done the heat vision and explained the situation. They've got that journal. And they know it has a secret and they never open it.
Yeah, yeah. There's no reading the journal. And that's the thing that I mean, like the idea is really cool, but like they just didn't bring it together well. You know, so did you ever read the book Holes, Michael?
I did not.
Louis Sacker?
Yeah, I know Louis Sacker, but I never read that book.
Yeah, or Sakar. I don't know. I pronounced his name incorrectly for 35 years of my life, and then I learned the right way to pronounce it, and now I think I do a blend, or it's like half right and half the way I used to say it. Anyway, brilliant author, really, really good book. Holes is an excellent, excellent book, and the reason I bring it up here is because it's got a similar plot element to this, where there was something that happened 100 years ago. It was 100 years ago, just like in this movie, and it's affecting what's going on in the modern world. And obviously a novel is different, you know, where he's able to interweave it and have different like perspectives. And for a little while, like for some chapters, you're in the, you know, the 1800s, and then you're, you know, back in the 1900s, because I think that book came out maybe early 2000s. So maybe it was, you know, whatever. Anyway, early 19, whatever. 100 years difference. You know what I mean? But it comes together so nicely. Like they're trying to solve this mystery, and there's, you know, things from the past and things from the present, like have this like interweaving. And I just feel like, that was right there for them. And they just didn't quite get it, you know? And there is a movie version that Disney did of Holes. And it's not nearly as good as the book, but even so, like, I felt like it's like, it's right there, you know, like there's a way to do this well. And again, like the movie is not as good as the book, but I felt like it was better than this movie. And just in that aspect of like interweaving the, what was going on 100 years ago and what was going on today, that was different than just like, you know, here's an information drop, you know, and we're gonna get one single flashback scene that Judy Hopps somehow has, and it doesn't make any sense. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, maybe if she had spent the entire journey back to Tundra Town reading the journal, her putting the story together would have made more sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, yeah, I mean, you have I'm sure they experimented with some of the stuff. They must have, right? But like, you have some, like, you know, the movie opens in the year, whatever, 1926, you know, with the, you know, with the reptiles. And then, you know, so you get like the flashback early on, and then it's like, well, what happened, you know, or something, you know. But I just feel like there was some other ways to do it than the way they did it. The way they did it, just, it felt kind of flat. It was a cool idea that I did not feel they executed well.
Well, and what's interesting, they did open with a flashback, but it was a flashback to the first movie.
Yeah, that's right. Just in case you forgot. It's been 10 years, which is, it might as well be 100 years in our current pop culture era, you know?
That's true.
So.
Here's a question. Did you see the twist coming with the Andy Samberg links?
I feel the same way as the beaver. Like, should have seen that coming. Like, why didn't I see it coming? He has such a Hans vibe from Frozen. Like, it's like the same storyline.
Right. You know? I mean, when, like, they did that for a while, right? They were, where the villain was always someone who was very close to the protagonists. And they hadn't done that in a while. They'd moved to this, oh, well, there is no villain. The real villain is childhood trauma or whatever. And so it was kind of refreshing to have an actual villain, so much so that I didn't think that maybe there would be a twist friend villain. So it caught me really off guard.
It caught me off guard, but I think part of the reason that it catches you off guard is because his plot is so convoluted and makes no sense. You know, like why, like he's, you know, embedded himself with this snake and with Judy. Like he could have turned on them at any time. Like why wait until that moment? Like what? Like he didn't need them for. You know, once they know they're going to go turn the light switch on, like he doesn't need them. He doesn't really even need to go turn the light switch on. He has the book, you know, like if he knows that the book holds some sort of secret at that point, he could get, you know, like just get rid of the book. Like it's just, yeah, it's very, his heel turn. It's like, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Although, you know, he is kind of a dumb character. So maybe, you know.
and why would he not alert his family that this is what he's doing if he's on their side the whole time and he sets himself up to be not on their side, especially given that they are clearly trying to kill the people who were going against them?
Right. Yeah. And yeah. And his whole thing is he wants to prove himself to them, you know? So I guess that's the only, to answer that question, the only like stretch answer you could give is like maybe he thinks his brother or his sister is going to try and do it instead, because after he gives them the idea, because he's such a mess up or a screw up that they won't trust him with this plan, so he has to do it secretly. But I don't know, it was fine.
Yeah, it's a moment. It's a moment that hits hard, but when you think about it later, it makes less sense.
Yeah, which I think that's just the thing with this movie. Like, it's a good movie and it's a fun movie, but it's not going to be a movie that just stays with me for a long time. Like, it didn't have, I don't know, whatever that other like oomph piece is, you know, like that heart piece or that emotion piece. Like, it was funny. It was a very funny movie, and it was clever. It's well put together. But it's just, you know, it was fine.
you weren't moved by the relationship between Hobbs and Wilde?
I really like their relationship. I mean, I really enjoyed them like being together. I also like, I don't know. There was a point in the movie when I wondered if she was ever going to come around. Like she seemed so like, you know, like when they pop out of the tubes and he's like, oh, I think some sorries are in order. And she's like, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's like, oh man. That's the one that really got me. I was like, oh my gosh, he's never going to get it. You know?
But
like,
I mean, it was nice that they showed both of them as misunderstanding the other one. I thought that was really, that was a nuanced picture of that relationship that they didn't have to do. They could have made it just where Wilde didn't understand her, but instead they really did make it mutual, and that both of them had to change if they were going to continue to work together. I really liked the scene where he tells her that it's not worth dying for, and she quite understandably mistakes that for an expression of self-interest on his part. This is not worth me dying for. But also when at the end of the movie, he says he was talking about her, you believe that too. Like I really thought that was handled well. That was actually an expression of him caring for her, even though it's totally understandable why she would read that as a selfish thing.
Yeah, she's like not fully recovered from her you know, stereotype of him as a, you know, as a con artist or whatever, you know, from the first movie. For as much as she enjoys him, she's still like there's that little bit of her that's still holding on to that and is still viewing him through that lens.
Well, right. And also he's announced himself to be a solitary animal several times already in the movie. You know, yeah. So it makes sense that he would be talking about himself. How did you read it when he first when he first said it? I read it as him talking about both of them.
Yeah, I did too. Like I did not. I think they did a really nice job, actually. This is another part of the movie that I didn't consider until you're asking me about it. But you're right; they did a really nice job with this, especially having seen it twice. Because on the second time through, you notice that he is worried about her all the way through, you know? So this isn't like one of those like gotcha moments where, you know, he colors it in that way and then it doesn't make sense. Like when you watch it the second time, you can see that, you know, he's worried about her jumping out the window. He's worried about her, like, you know, going up against the lynxes when they're these killers, you know, like it's not all selfish all the way through. So yeah, I think they did a really nice job with that.
One thing that did bug me throughout the movie was them continuing to go undercover when they are famous.
Yeah.
How are you going to go undercover when you have just been on the news? Also,
yeah.
The first time they go,
the anteater didn't seem to recognize them.
No, so. Nobody does, and until they need to. But in the first one, they're going undercover as a married couple trying to catch this anteater smuggler.
Yeah.
They can't reproduce. So what's the idea behind them having a baby? Like, who's going to believe that?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It was, yeah. Again, I feel like there's some places in this movie where it's just played for laughs.
Right, I'm analyzing it too much.
No, but I mean that's what we do, is we analyze these movies. I mean, I had the same thought. I was like, this doesn't make any sense at all. You know, it's. But I think it's one of the parts of the movie that works on multiple levels, because it does work. For the anteater does buy it, even though they're totally famous and they couldn't have kids. And at the same time, you can imagine that Chief Bogo is like, what are they doing? Like, this is never going to work. Like, you can see it, like him thinking the same way that you're thinking, right? Like Chief Bogo would think exactly like you, like, this undercover, like, you guys can't be married, you're famous, like, how would any of this happen, how would any of this work, you know, like, that's why I can't send you on these missions,
right? So, and what, and then to top it off, their excuse that their baby has had this accident and all he wants is this anteater's signature is I mean, it's so absurd that you would have to be a moron to believe it. So you're right. I mean, yeah. Maybe the point is how silly their undercover disguise is, as opposed to when they go undercover at the gala. There it kind of works, right? And there's that great scene where you see why she needs Wilde, which is he gets them beyond the velvet curtain by by helping that woman and then pretending to be her date. And I mean, it's just seamless. They just walk through the curtain and you see why Hops's approach, which is very go in with guns blazing, isn't going to work at all times. And she needs this more sophisticated, prudent con artist to help her get through. And it's interesting because, I mean, you've kind of got gender reversal there, because normally you would, in a movie like this, the male character would be the one who wants to rush in and the female character would be more prudent, but they switch those roles in a kind of interesting way.
Yeah.
I don't remember. They must do that in the first one too, right? Because she's so enthusiastic.
Yeah, I think it's her enthusiasm over everything that's the difference.
Yeah, it's not and a question. She doesn't
and her think. Very black and white view of the world. So,
and
as far as like justice and you know, things must be made right. So,
and something you can imagine a rabbit doing. They don't seem like great thinkers. Maybe not. I read Watership Down.
Yeah, I've never read. I mean, I know I should. That's one of those books that you should read, but I've never actually read it.
I just read it last year. It's quite good. Yeah, but and then of course the foxes are mythically, legendarily crafty, so that does make sense. It's less a gender thing than it is a species thing. We're back to the idea that, well, actually, things do have a nature.
Yeah, in this case they do, right? So actually in most cases they do. I mean, that was the whole thing with the first movie that was so irritating, was even as they were making these statements that there is no nature, it was just so obvious that nature was there.
Yeah, so many of the gags depend on it.
Yeah.
Did you find yourself wondering why the sea lions didn't have cognizance? The sea lions are animals.
Right. Well, they had some sort of cognizance. They know they don't like being called seals.
Yeah, that's true. It's like Goofy and Pluto, I guess. When the gag requires it to be an animal, it has to be an animal. Yeah. I think they were the only animals in the movie that were animals, though, as opposed to people.
Yeah, other than hopefully the fish.
That's right, yeah. I guess there are still obligate carnivores.
Yeah.
And you do imagine that Lynx family to be secretly eating the other denizens of Zootopia.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
Were you surprised that the wild pig was a woman?
I guess. I don't know.
I mean, I looked it up, and female wild pigs do have tusks. So I mean, it definitely could have been.
I think
it could have been female.
Yeah, I think it was the accent that threw me off more than anything. That. Yeah, but.
And then I was also surprised to learn that the beaver was female, because when she is first on the screen, I mean, maybe it's just that I think of YouTube conspiracy theorists as being men. But
yeah, there's the gender reversal right there.
That character was the closest thing to an annoying, dopey style character in the movie, I think.
Yeah, I was wondering how you felt about the
movie. She was all right, and she was definitely necessary for the movie. But she was a little much for me. I thought I wasn't going to like Gary after his first appearance, but he was fun.
Yeah, Gary was okay. I didn't understand the... So he keeps repeating himself at the end, like, we shall succeed, we shall succeed. And it was like... It felt like it was, I just wasn't sure what it was supposed to be, you know, like self-hypnosis.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it fits in. So if the movie is a conflict between hope and cynicism, he kind of shows you another way to be hopeful. You know, it's this very hard one. He's suffered so much. His people have suffered so much, and yet he still goes on. The last line of the last line of The Sound and the Fury, where it's talking about the black slave or black servant, excuse me, she's not a slave, Dilsey, and it says they endured. I kind of feel that way about the snakes. They endured.
Yeah, and I thought along those lines, like maybe this is like, it's almost like a we shall overcome thing, like we shall succeed. And it's like calling to that. And like, there's been like, it's been 100 years. And this is like the mantra that his family and all the snakes and all the reptiles have kind of passed down. But there's nothing in the movie to let you know that, like you have to come to that yourself, which is fine. Like that often makes a viewing experience richer when you have to come to it yourself. But in a movie where he got so few lines, for his one line to be that one and be repeated several times, I was just like, I don't know. It just, it.
Well, and actually they
didn't quite work for me.
They try to shoehorn this other thing in there where he keeps saying that one animal can't take the world on his shoulders, which felt out of place to me. Like that seems like a message from a different movie that maybe they could have used a couple times he did that to draw out the fact that he comes from this incredibly suffering race instead of this weird thing about taking the whole world on your shoulder. That felt like a remnant of an earlier draft of the movie.
Yeah, I think you're right, because that actually, like, yeah, because I mean, that is Judy Hopps's problem in some ways, is she is trying to take the whole world on her shoulders and do it all herself in some ways, you know, but not, I mean, in other ways, it's not, I mean, it is that in the sense that she has to prove herself to everyone, as she admits, you know, but, it seems like the main conflict in the movie is just that she feels like her way of seeing things and doing things is the only way of seeing things and doing things to such an extent that she doesn't even, like, it doesn't even register her to her that that Nick wouldn't be on the same page, you know, that he would see it in any different way. Like the larger message seems to be that she feels like we're not different. And then once she realizes that they are different is when she actually has to, like, come to terms with that. Like, well, what does that mean that we're different? You know?
Right. Yeah. She's trying to, I mean, to go back to our complaint about the first movie, she's trying to deny natural difference. And then when she's actually faced with a form of nature that won't change, maybe not a species-based nature, but at least an individual-based nature, she just wants to wash her hands of the whole thing, wash her paws of the whole thing.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and I felt like, again, I feel like I'm repeating myself a little bit, maybe, that part was really nicely done. And that whole scene takes place at the honeymoon lodge, which, you know, is hilarious that it's the honeymoon lodge that they're having their big breakup of their partnership at. But that I felt like that whole section was like from the time they're climbing up on the ropes, actually from the time they come out of the tubes and he's like, I think some sorries are in order. And she's like, it's okay. And then, you know, the pen, which is the symbol of their partnership, breaks. And the animation on that part in particular, like the way they both react, but there's no words. It's all in the animation of their faces. And you can see that they're both reacting in very different ways to the breaking of that pen. And then, you know, on into the honeymoon stage where it finally comes to a head and she says, yeah, I guess we are different. Like, maybe I liked more than a third of the movie. Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one thing I admire,
talking me into it here.
One thing I admired about this movie was its willingness to make her unsympathetic, at least for a little while. I mean, you still like her. It's too cute a character not to like, but She is clearly in the wrong in a way that a lesser movie, I think, would not have allowed her to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And Moana 2 would not have allowed her to be, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Like that was one of our things in Moana 2 was like, yeah. Yeah.
Huh. I would also say this movie has about the darkest 90 seconds of any Disney movie after Judy gets stabbed with the snake poison and she is dying on the floor and the snake is outside in the cold and he's also dying. And then, I mean, the part that really got me was, Pawbert gets the beaver right in the heart with the snake venom. And, and I thought she was dead because she just immediately fell over. Whereas Judy takes some time. I mean, that was a dark sequence.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, he takes a real, real sharp turn.
Yeah.
Hobbert.
Murderous.
Yes. The same guy that you were laughing at just, you know, minutes earlier with a great cat gag.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, turn it off.
Turn it off. His bachelor pad.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're not wrong. That is a very dark sequence. Yeah, I was actually going to ask you how, like, so I mentioned that he, you know, he felt a lot like Hans to me, but like how he compares to some of the other Disney villains that we've had, because we have gone through a bit of a stage of no Disney villain. And so
it's nice to have one back.
Where he ranks.
I mean, he's such a doofus for so long, and then he becomes so evil. And then there's the scene where he's lost his mind and, like, pops up to burn the entire house down.
Yeah, that's weird.
You can see how that would scare a child. It didn't scare me because
definitely
44 years old. But
no, yeah, you're right. He's got that, like, that Cruella de Vil madness, you know?
I don't think he's one of the great villains, but I do think he's more interesting than most of the villains we've had in the last 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
I mean, now that I think about it, they did the same thing with Bellwether from the first movie. Right? That she was kind of comic relief and then became evil. She wasn't, but she wasn't as evil as he is.
Right. Well, this is one of the lines that I missed the first time through and then caught it on the second time through, because she says, last time there, our last miss, there was a bit of a twist, and he says, I know. And then he stabs her and he's like, oh my gosh, I thought you knew, because like now he's the twist, you know, like he thought that when she was saying last time, there's a bit of a twist, that she was talking about him, being the twist, because you're right, it is very similar to Bellwether. So I missed that line the first time through.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So they acknowledge it, that it's very similar. But I don't know, it's been a while since I watched the first Zootopia, and I did not care for the first Zootopia, so I don't it's hard for me to compare the two, because I just don't remember exactly the way that twist played out.
Yeah, I don't either.
Other than it existing.
I will say, another thing I appreciated about this movie is there were not that many returning characters. And for the most part, the ones that did, they kind of kept on the sidelines. So Bogo is back, but he doesn't play a major role. Bellwether has a couple of scenes that are played well, mm-hmm. I think. Even the sloth, which I think would have been a really annoying gag to have 10-15 minutes of, like in the first movie, he comes back for just a couple of scenes and he's very good in them. Like they use that very well. The shrew, the mob boss shrew, is used well. So I thought they did a good job of not just repeating the first movie, despite the twist being similar. It's a very different sort of movie, which, if you're going to do a sequel, is a good way to do a sequel.
Yeah, you know, you're really right on that, Michael. And that's another thing that I did not think of, but you're really right, because the leopard thing that works at the, is it a leopard or a tiger? I don't remember.
I think it's a
cheetah.
Works
at the, cheetah. Yeah, that's probably right. The cheetah is only he's only in there just the right amount, you know?
Yeah, that's
like,
right.
Just enough to be funny, but it's not a, it's not an instance of, you know, I've never seen this movie, but I'm going to use it, like Minions, you know, where you like, you take the annoying side character and you make the whole movie about them, you know, like it's not that.
Or Cars, so. Cars 2, Cars 3, which one was all about Mater? I don't think I saw one past the first one. I think it's Cars 2 where Mater is the main character.
Yeah, that could, I don't remember. It's been too long since I've seen those. I mean, yeah, Cars is a great movie.
You know, a lot of people don't like Cars, awesome. But I really liked Cars.
Yeah. They're entitled to their wrong opinion.
I think it's widely considered to be the worst of the Pixar Golden Age.
Yeah, and it may be.
Yeah, which is more a testament fair. To how strong the other movies are.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, yeah, there's got to be a worse among the greats, you know, but like, it's still pretty darn good.
Yeah, and way better than anything they've done in the last 15 years, except maybe Inside Out. I never saw Inside Out 2. Yeah.
Luca is really good.
I never saw Luca, and I did like Soul.
Yeah,
I should say I thought Soul was a pretty good movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny, like. It's like with all these things, you know, like you think the ride will never end, you know, like when Pixar was in its like first, like it was so good, you know, and you just think like they're never going to make a bad movie. And then of course they did, or, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe felt like that for a little
while. It really did. Yeah.
It cannot miss. And now, you know, and then at some point you just kind of like, they have too many misses in a row and you're like, yeah, what's the last Pixar movie I even watched? I don't know. You know?
I'm still going to go see the new Spider-Man, though.
Oh, yeah. The Spider-Mans haven't missed yet, you know?
That's true. Yeah, the third Spider-Man was pretty
good. The cinematic universe. Yeah. So, yeah.
I was going to say something, and now I lost it.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. It doesn't matter. Oh, yeah, I was going to say, it's like when you're following a recording artist and every new album comes out and you think, is this going to be the one I hate? Mm-hmm. Do you have that experience? Like, you've been following
someone I always for a hope long it's time, not,
but, and you yeah. almost don't want them to put out another album because you've liked everything they've done.
Right. Like, there's a real tension there where
every time Jason Isbell puts out a new album, I think, is this going to be the one? And it hasn't been yet, but I'm sure eventually. I mean, everybody loses the spark, at least temporarily.
Yeah, or they just go in a direction that's different than the direction you're growing it. You're growing as a fan in a direction that's different than what they're doing as an artist or whatever.
Yeah, and I would say that one's your fault. You know, like that one, you've got to be open enough to where if they change the sound or they change the sort of thing they're doing, you have to be okay with that, and instead of expecting them to make the same thing over and over again. And that's true with movies and that's true with music and everything else. It's like,
yeah.
Or, you know, the other thing is TV seasons. You'll have a show that just has a world historically good season, and you know the next one can't live up to it.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's how I feel. Like, you know, they just recently announced that Ted Lasso is coming back for a fourth season. And it's like, I don't know. You know, like, I loved it, but do I want a fourth season? I don't know.
Especially if it's been a while, you know it's not going to be good. That new season of King of the Hill, like, I was excited on some level to see more King of the Hill because it's a show I love so much. But at the same time, you knew it wasn't going to be as good because TV series especially are lightning in a bottle. They require so many different things to be perfect. And you just, like, mm-hmm. 15 years later, you're not going to be able to catch that. You know, you've got to have a whole writer's room of people who are super tuned in to the thing. And you're just not going to get, that's why TV shows almost always go down after the third season, because writer's contracts, at least they used to be, I don't know if they still are, TV writer's contracts are 3 seasons. So after the third season of a TV show, you get a decline because you lose a bunch of the original writers. Maybe not all of them. That's what makes The Simpsons so remarkable, is they kept putting out good seasons for almost a decade.
Yeah. And they're still going.
I've watched probably 4 episodes in the last 10 years of The Simpsons, although I did see one that was really good. There was a Halloween episode that wasn't a Treehouse of Horror. Like, Lisa got scared at a haunted house or something, and it's Homer trying to deal with that. It was actually a really good episode of The Simpsons. I don't remember the name of it. I don't remember what season it is.
Yeah.
I don't even know what season this is on. They're on like 35 right. or some ridiculous number.
Yeah.
Oh. You saw
one of the things I most.
They're making a third Zootopia, right?
Oh, I'm sure they are.
I'm sure it's going to be about the birds, right?
That's what
Disney's
doing now.
I didn't see the end of credits sequence, but birds show up. Is that right?
Yeah. So what happens in the end of, it was funny. So, my daughter, it was like, oh, the next one's going to be about the birds. Like, I don't know. This is like right at the end, like before the credits, you know,
cause there's no
like
birds
near the end of the movie. There. Cause there's no birds, you know? And, so she said that, and then we always watch the credits and the end of credits stuff. So we watch the end of credits, and Judy's talking to her neighbors, if you remember the neighbors from the first one. Then she leaves, and it's on the windowsill. And as she leaves, a shadow flies over, and then a feather falls onto her windowsill.
So, gotcha.
And that's it. So.
Well, I mean,
yeah, you definitely know, birds for the next one.
This one was pretty good. I would prefer they make original movies just like you would, but if the sequels are good, it's better than bad originals like Wish and Strange World. Oof.
Yeah, and I feel like we're in this like hard spot where it's like the originals have not been good. Like we can hold out hope for Hexed, you know, like that Hexed is good, but I feel like we're in this like this dark time where it's like sequels, which are hit or miss, and then originals, which are mostly miss. Although I really, I liked Encanto, and Raya and the Last Dragon. So,
and Kanzo and Raya were both, you know, I would say, fine to good.
Yeah.
In Kanto, I think I would prefer Raya.
Yeah. I think I would like them both better than this one, at least, but I don't know. I'd have to think about it.
I think I haven't seen those in a long time, but I think I liked this one better than that. Those. They're very different movies, though. I mean, all three of them are very good. Like, Raya is a pretty serious movie for a lot of its run, although there's some comedy in that as well.
And, yeah, there's quite a bit of comedy.
Encanto is a musical. So, I mean, that's just already something different.
And the musicals are always harder to... Right. They're harder to compare because you've got the songs and stuff. Speaking of the songs, real quick, we have Michael Giacchino. How do you say his name?
Giacchino, I think. Giacchino, probably. Giacchino? I think in Italian, you pronounce that G-I-A is like Giacomo instead of Giacomo.
Yeah. Well, he's very good in a lot of, like, I mean, he's done some incredible soundtracks. I was surprised to see that he's only done Zootopia and Zootopia 2 for Disney. He's got a million Pixar credits and then a million other, outside of animation credits also, but he's only done Zootopia and Zootopia 2. I thought the little opening, the synthesizer bit, like over the castle and stuff, I was like, oh man, who did the music for this movie? I really like it. And then after that, it's all jokes and stuff, and you don't even notice the music.
I was going to say, I didn't notice the music at all, other than the horrible Shakira song.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was, the less said about that, the better.
Yeah. Yeah. Giacchino is such a memorable composer. His, that theme from Up. That's got to be one of the best movie themes ever.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's up there with like the Psycho string thing in terms of string hit. What am I trying to say? Sting. In terms of memorable movie themes, or Home Alone. Home Alone's got great music.
Yeah,
or of course, Star Wars, Indiana Jones. I guess there's actually a lot of memorable themes.
But all three that you just named are John Star Williams. Wars and are John Williams. Yeah,
and Jaws. Jones,
those are all John Williams.
And who did?
So
Bernard Herrmann did Psycho. What were you about to say about John Williams?
Oh, I mean, he's on his own level, like he's got so many memorable themes. But yeah, I feel like Giacchino or whatever, however you say his name, has done some really nice work. So
yeah,
it was fun seeing his name on it.
He's going to be the best of the modern film composers. I don't know who you would put up next to him.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know, because so many modern soundtrack. Like, if I really like a soundtrack, it's often more a soundtrack than a score.
Right.
So yeah, as far as modern scores, I would. Yeah, he's probably the only one I could name, at least,
Well, so. And a lot of the big movies are still using composers from the previous generation. Like, the Avengers theme is Robert Zemeckis. That's the Alan Silvestri is the composer who did Back to the Future. Another great theme.
Oh, really? I didn't know it was the same guy that did Back to the Future.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah, the Avengers theme is not as good as Back to the Future, but, what is?
Yeah. Anything else to say on this movie, or is that it?
I think that's about it. Next month, we'll be back to 1001 Nights.
That's right.
That very long story. I'm about halfway through it.
Novel that's in the middle of it, yeah. Well, our press liaison is Christian Philippic, and we're on the old interwebs at christianhumanist.org. Please help us continue this conversation by reaching out to us at beforetheywerelive@gmail.com. Check out Michael's weekly podcast, A Symposium of Popular Song, over at Front Porch Republic. And we also want to encourage you to set your podcast player's dials to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, where you'll find an abundance of old shows and some occasional new shows to keep you going. Michael, I know there are a great number of podcasts out there you could be spending your time on, so thank you for spending the time with us. So for Michael Farmer, I'm Joshua Altman-Schofer, reminding you, pro tip, if he goes to the red line, do not follow. You will run out of air. Good luck. I love you.